Genetically modified organisms, the future of food, or Frankenfood? There's a lot of misinformation out there surrounding GMOs, and there's no shortage of opinions about them. Today, we'll hear about the first genetically modified animal approved for human consumption and its connection to Indiana. And we'll hear from experts on the environmental, economic, and agricultural impact of GMOs. That's this hour on All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're joined in studio by Indiana Public Broadcasting reporter Samantha Horton, who's been reporting on Aqua Bounty, producer of genetically modified salmon being grown right here in Indiana. We'll also hear from Purdue Professor of Agricultural Economics Wally Tyner on the consequences of banning GMOs. And later we'll be joined by IUPUI Professor of Earth Sciences Gabe Filippelli and Purdue Professor of Botany and Plant Pathology Dr. Peter Goldsboro. Of course, we'll take your questions and comments on Facebook and Twitter. Find us at All In Indiana. First, this news. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Indiana is an agricultural behemoth. From our numerous farmers and vast crop fields to the biotech industry and research entities like Purdue, we have all the bases covered. And now we can add the first genetically modified animal approved for human consumption in the U.S. Salmon, produced by Massachusetts-based Aqua Bounty Technologies, will be grown in Albany, Indiana, hundreds of miles from the nearest ocean. At a time when, for some, GMOs are still too new a concept to be fully understood, is Indiana leading the industry? Or are GMOs too much like playing God? We'll take your questions and comments on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Indiana Public Broadcasting Samantha Horton's been covering Aqua Bounty, and she joins us now. Hi, Samantha.
Hey, Matt. How are you?
I'm great. But when I hear genetically modified salmon, I immediately begin wondering how it might be different from traditionally farmed or wild-caught salmon. What's different about this fish?
So they went in and gene spliced. The idea was to speed up salmon growth and reduce the amount of feed needed for the salmon to grow. So they gene spliced two other genes from other one from another salmon and then another from another fish and put those in to create the Aqua Bounty salmon.
Do you know anything about the timeline of how long it took to sort of develop this and how when they started working on this or perhaps the other fish that they stole genes from to do this?
I mean, this goes back decades ago. They've been working on this for a while, and it just has been a timeline of going through FDA approval and also being able to bring the eggs into the U.S. to be able to produce. So this is nothing that they just started last year or anything.
And growing the fish this way is nothing new either. I mean, we just started doing it in Indiana, but they've been doing it elsewhere for a while too, right?
Yeah, aquaculture has been a growing type market out there of businesses getting into it. It's in a variety of stages. Commercial, though, is definitely, I think, something that we're starting to see happening now around the country and around the world as things have evolved and companies realize there's this accessibility that can happen now with these land-based options.
And the way that these fish are grown is sort of different from other farmed salmon, right?
So, I mean, they're in tanks compared to net pens in the ocean, which is a more traditional freshwater farm-raised salmon out there. I'm just referring to salmon because that's supposed to be what my reporting has been on. And so they're in tanks. They're contained in these tanks, and they grow out there. So there's not the worries of bacteria and some of the other things that in freshwater you might have concerns about.
And shows you what I knew about farming salmon. I assumed that it was done that way, in tanks or perhaps in like hatcheries like you might see in rural Indiana. But indeed, it's done out in the ocean with giant nets. And that's how they're farmed, right?
Yeah. So for the most part, yes.
Well, I would imagine then that giant nets in the ocean raises a number of environmental concerns, right? I mean, this approach, the one being undertaken in Indiana, seems like it sort of eliminates that problem, right?
So I think the idea is, yeah, so it's the whole idea in the matter of when you put a bunch of fish in net pens, like I was mentioning about bacteria and things that have to be treated then to keep the water and the fish healthy. Then with this, though, because you're eliminating that fresh water aspect to it, you're now putting them in tanks where they're filtering the water. There's a lot more containment in. You don't have to worry about treating for bacteria.
It's a 100% controlled environment.
Yes.
As opposed to out in the sea where really anything can happen.
That, from my understanding, yes, that's exactly what it is.
And doing it here, of course, increases the freshness of the food too, right?
So it's bringing it closer to consumers. That's one of the big things Aqua Bounty, when I talked with them, when I've done this reporting, has been pushed, is the idea of bringing it to the consumers. Right now, the U.S. imports a lot of the salmon that is consumed here. And so the idea is, by having this land-based facility, people in Chicago, in Indianapolis, all in these areas can have easier access to the fish, where it might take a day or two to arrive at a location. Now it's just hours.
I always think about, like, say, a nice seafood restaurant in Indy or Chicago or something like that. And you think, oh, how, I mean, fresh fish flown in daily, how fresh is that? Could that possibly be? But now, I mean, we're still a few years down the road on actually seeing this on a plate, as I understand. But now it's raised in Indiana.
Yeah, and the idea is too, carbon footprint. It's when you're thinking of jet fuel and what it costs to fly the fish in, because it is on a, you know, once the fish is ready to go to market, you have a timeline essentially before that fish would go bad. Now they're right. It's right here down the highway where they can easily tap into these markets and bring the fish quicker to their customers.
And we've seen, or we know that we're still a while away from actually eating some of this fish that's grown in Indiana. But have people from the company talked to you at all about the marketing? Like, will they tout it as having been grown in Indiana, or will they try to keep that a little quiet? Do you know, have they talked to you about that at all?
Well, based off of what I've talked with them about before, I think they've really highlighted this land-based facility in the sense of the fact that it is bringing closer consumers. It is really it's a commercial facility that's really sparking the whole aquaculture industry for the U.S. There's other locations that it is happening, but this is one of the highlighted companies that is doing it here, just maybe possibly because it is a genetically engineered salmon that's really causing a lot of spotlight on it. But the idea is, I think they're really trying to push, like, we are in the middle of the country. We're not on a coast producing this.
Well, and I would think that the risk to farming this genetically modified salmon in the ocean, say, is too great, right? There'd be a problem if these fish got into the wild, or am I wrong about that?
There's several aspects to that. There's the fact that the fish are bred as sterile. They're sterile. They're females. They're sterile. They're triploid. So they can't breed. There obviously, though, is so much I can say. They can't guarantee that there always is that small chance that it could happen.
I'm thinking of Jurassic Park.
So they do step it up, though, in the fact of the facility has several containment measures that are taken to where the fish really are not able to get out. And from what I understand, also, the chances of survival would be very limited.
I mean, does that have anything to do with the fact that this is being done in Indiana? Like, did they pick in the middle of the country so that it completely eliminates their chances of any of these fish getting out into the wild? Like, they're grown here, they're essentially killed here, and then shipped.
Being land-based does have that value added of there are no major body of water, so they're very limited on, yes, getting out into the ocean, getting out into somewhere that they could be a problem. But like I said, they've also taken steps to where getting it out of the facility, even land-based, would be a challenge.
Let's talk about the company itself. As we said, it's based in Massachusetts, but the fish are grown here in Indiana, in Albany, Indiana, actually. And as I understand, eggs are grown in Canada, but Aqua Bounty had a hurdle to get through before they could start growing salmon here, mm-hmm. Right?
So the eggs are produced on Prince Edward Island, and so they've been there. The issue has been, though, getting the import ban lifted on the eggs. Right now, they had been a ban to bring the eggs into the country while they were technically allowed to produce the fish in the country. So it was kind of they were allowed to the fish to be able to be grown, but they couldn't bring the eggs in to grow them. So there was a limited ability there.
But they were banking on the import ban being lifted, right? Yes. They bought the facility in Albany before the import ban was lifted. Mm-hmm. So they're just kind of planning on that.
Yeah. So they bought the facility from another aquaculture company called Bell Aquaculture back in 2017, I believe. And so that company was going belly up, so to speak. And so they...
Thanks for that.
So Aqua Bounty took advantage and bought that facility and was fitting and making it work for their production. So they had to go in and do renovations and preparing for when the import ban would be lifted.
And can you describe the Indiana facility? You've been there a few times. How do they do it there?
So it's like warehouses is kind of how I describe it. It's these big warehouses with tanks that I would pretty much describe as giant They're like outdoor swimming pools.
They're like above ground swimming pools.
Yeah,
almost.
Very, very large above ground swimming pools. And you know, we're talking about tons of water in these tanks to fulfill the need for the salmon. And they have different size tanks for each, depending on the size of the salmon and where it is and its growth. And then, so it's pretty much those facilities. It's not a big mass scale place as maybe as you think, but they fill out the facility with the production stuff.
Does Aqua Bounty have other products either planned or already in production?
They're working on a few others. I know they're working. I'm not sure where. I haven't reported on this, but I know that I've read and talked with them. They're working on trout and tilapia as a possible others that they're looking at tapping into those fish. And I'm not sure exactly what
they're
actually
trying to do. Genetically modifying them.
I believe so, but I don't want to go into that.
So what is their ultimate goal? What's Aqua Bounty's ultimate goal as a company?
So their ultimate goal is the accessibility, like we talked a little bit about, with bringing it close to consumers. And I think also the idea is really trying to meet the demands of a growing population. That's, I think, one of their things that when I've talked to the CEO, Sylvia Wolf, she mentioned that, you know, the world's population is growing, and to meet the demand for salmon, they're seeing themselves as thinking out of the box and how to address that.
Seafood is the number one protein in the world. You know, people eat more fish than they do almost anything else. And you've talked to some people at the company, and they've heard plenty of criticism for what they're doing. And what are some of the concerns that people have raised, and then what's their response?
So some of the groups I've talked to have concerns. Is some of it's just been there's not enough research, they feel. They haven't really felt like there's maybe enough research to the impact of human consumption with the GMO. And that can go into broader topics with GMOs in general. It's just a question of, you know, what does this have an impact on humans based off of how much is consumed?
And you've talked to some potential customers. You've talked to some customers who have already outright said, no, we're not going to carry this.
Yeah. So I talked to some restaurants in my last reporting on the company, and some are just very much against GMOs. They don't want to serve that in their restaurant. And then others are entertaining it because they see it as an option, and they're willing to at least explore the option and see if they decide to or if not serve it on their menu.
It seems like this approach to raising salmon, though, resolves a number of issues that some of those same people might be concerned with, not the least of which being the industry's carbon footprint.
So that is one thing that I think there's a lot of things at play here, and that's what makes it such a complex topic. Is there's the carbon footprint aspect. There's, you know, this idea of how long it takes salmon to grow. So by speeding it up, you're essentially increasing the amount of salmon available on the market. There's a lot of those.
How long will it be until I can dig into a fresh Aqua Bounty salmon steak with some dill and a nice Sauvignon Blanc? When will this come to the market?
So they just got their fish in the past couple of months. They got the eggs in, so they're hoping to have them on the shelves or in the market somehow by the end of next year.
We're talking with Indiana Public Broadcasting reporter Samantha Horton about the first genetically modified animal approved for human consumption, salmon, that can be raised in half the time on less food. And they're being grown right here in Indiana. Up next, we'll ask, what if the U.S. did what the EU has done and banned GMOs outright? Purdue Professor of Agricultural Economics Wally Tyner has that answer for us. And what questions do you have? Has anyone ever tried to scare you away from GMOs? Let us know on Facebook and Twitter. Find us at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. Back in a minute. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're discussing GMOs and all the science, marketing, and misinformation surrounding them. We'll take your questions and comments on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Do GMOs bring you hope for the future of food and humanity, or fear for the potential consequences? Here to help shed some light on GMOs is Wally Tyner, professor of agricultural economics at Purdue University. Wally, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
You're joining us remotely, so I can't see your face, but did your eyes roll a little at the mention of GMO's potential consequences?
Well, when we did our analysis on GMOs and later on glyphosate, we asked a little bit different question, because a lot of people think GMOs have problems, that we ought to get rid of them, they ought to be banned. And so the question we asked was, okay, what happens if they are banned? What are the economic consequences? What are the greenhouse gas consequences for the climate, et cetera, if they're banned? So that's what we focused on.
Well, what do you think is among the worst of the misinformation out there surrounding GMOs?
Well, I think that people are not told that if they didn't exist, food prices would go up, the commodity prices would go up, so it would cost them more to eat. And also, and this is the thing that surprised us the most, greenhouse gas emissions go up. So why would greenhouse gas emissions go up if you ban GMOs? Well, the reason is that the crop yields go down, so you need more land to get the same amount of food or similar amount of food produced. And that means you're going to be converting forest, you're going to be converting pasture. And when you convert that forest and convert that pasture to grow corn and soybeans and other crops, that releases greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere. So the same, some of the same groups that want to prevent increases in greenhouse gas emissions also want to ban GMOs. You can't have it both ways. So that was the most surprising result for us was that, in fact, the greenhouse gas emissions associated with the ban on GMOs, just in the United States, is about the same as the total greenhouse gas emissions from all land use change effects of the U.S. ethanol program. So it's not a small number.
So from what I can see from your writing, there are three major consequences to banning GMOs. You mentioned most of them, and the one that I'm kind of curious about is the loss of forest or land for pasture. And that, as you kind of explained, was so that we can add more land to grow non-GMO plants because they need a little bit more room, I guess.
That's right. The yields tend to be lower in non-GMO. So if you're trying to produce 100 tons and you need a certain amount of land to produce that, you're going to need more land with non-GMOs. And so the land that gets allocated to crops increases. And since land is fixed in quantity, that means that the land that gets allocated to pasture and forest by arithmetic has to go down. That's the thing that, I mean, we knew that since GMO crops have lower yields, that the commodity prices would go up. We didn't know how much. And we knew that those increases in commodity prices would have some impact. It's a pretty small impact on food prices, but it's there. But we really were interested in the result on greenhouse gas emissions.
What do we know about allocation of land? Do we have data on how much farmland in the U.S. is dedicated to GMOs versus others?
Yeah, in the U.S., we have good data. It's not necessarily all over the world, although the second paper we did on glyphosate, one of our co-authors from United Kingdom had really good data on GM crops all over the world. But in the United States, we have really good data. And it's for corn and soybeans, it's 95%, 92%. It's most of the corn and soybeans.
Is there a future that you see where we're using even less land because we're expanding the use of GMOs?
Yeah, I think what's happening today is that we're starting to use what are called stacked technologies. So there'll be one stack of GMO to help prevent weeds, glyphosate resistance. There'll be another stack for a corn root worm. There'll be another stack for something else. And so as the technology evolves and the scientists are able to get new traits that they can put into the corn, then the whole objective of doing that is to get higher yields off the existing area.
The third main consequence that I've been able to glean from your writing is higher food prices, right? And so if I, say, went to the grocery store and spent $100 today in a world without GMOs, I don't know, could you tell me about what I would have spent to get the same stuff?
Food prices go up about a little over 1%. Now, that sounds like a small number, right? 1%, that's a pocket change. But when you add it up for the whole country, it's $14 to $24 billion a year that an additional that we spend on food that we wouldn't have spent otherwise. That means $14 to $24 billion a year that we can't spend on whatever else we would close or recreation or housing or whatever else we would want to spend it on. So, and we only spend about 10% of our disposable income on food. So a 1% increase, yeah, it doesn't sound like much, but bottom line is that it can be significant, particularly for poor people.
We're exploring the idea of the consequences, rather, of banning GMOs with Purdue professor Wally Tyner. The three main consequences, it seems, are loss of forest land for pasture, also greenhouse gas emissions, and higher food prices. What am I missing? Other possible consequences?
Well, those are the main ones for banning GMOs. We also looked at it because probably a year or even less after we did the first paper, Europe proposed banning glyphosate, which is the chemical that works with GMO traits that lets you use that pesticide to kill weeds without harming the corn or the soybeans. And so then we said, okay, let's try to do an analysis of what would be the impacts of banning the glyphosate, not the GMO necessarily, just the glyphosate. And the interesting thing there, we also had increases in greenhouse gas emissions, because without the insect and weed resistance, you have lower yields. But the other interesting effect is that if you don't have glyphosate is, people would argue about the effects that it has, but on a scale that's used by the industry, it's not near as dangerous as many of the other possible pesticides and herbicides. And so if we ban glyphosate, then we have to switch to some of these others that have potentially much more serious consequences, and they're more costly. So that was the thing that surprised me a bit there. Glyphosate, I thought, okay, we take the reduced yields and go on. But in fact, what it appears farmers would do is there are other approved pesticides that they can use. But even though they're approved, they're more dangerous than glyphosate.
How did glyphosate get this target on its back?
Oh, that is a big question. I think it's fair to say that you almost have to go back to the early days of GMOs. And in the early days of GMOs, Monsanto and other companies, Monsanto at the time, and other companies were promoting GMOs because they were going to increase crop yields. And that wasn't a big deal for people. And so if instead of having done that, they had promoted GMOs because they're going to produce safer vaccines, they're going to produce medicines that will be more effective and less costly, or anything in the health arena, I think people's attitudes toward it would have been completely different. But they sort of just went plunged head in to, I believe this is good for you. And then there have been recently, as you know, some court cases where Monsanto was bought out by Bayer, and Bayer has lost most of the cases that have been filed because farmers that used glyphosate regularly developed health problems, and the lawyers were able to convince the juries that those problems were due to glyphosate. So that is the long way to long version of the story of how glyphosate got the name on its back.
Well, so glyphosate is, as you mentioned, a suspected carcinogen. Suspected. What is the official current scientific conclusion on glyphosate?
Well, in the U.S., glyphosate and other similar pesticides and herbicides are regulated by a combination of USDA, EPA, and FDA. In other words, Department of Agriculture, Food and Drug Administration, and the Environmental Protection Administration. All three of those agencies say glyphosate is safe and effective. There is an international council, and I can't remember the name of it right now, that's when we did the paper on glyphosate, when they announced that they believe that glyphosate was a potential carcinogen. I mean, there are a lot of other things in that category that you use every day that you wouldn't even think of. But because it got put in that category and it never was put in context, it got a lot of attention.
Let's get back to this idea of banning GMOs. We're not just exploring this idea because people have threatened it, right? Several countries have actually done so. What have been their reasonings?
Great question. In the EU, the reasoning is what the EU calls the precautionary principle. And the precautionary principle basically says, okay, the science may say it's okay, but there is some chance, albeit fairly small, there's some chance that there's a problem. And so we want to be on the side of safety and precaution, and so we're going to ban it. And then what happens is that any country then, and this particularly affects African countries, that exports to the EU can't really use GMO because the EU will not accept imports that have over something like 1% GMO content. When the EU makes this decision, it rebounds, it expands across the rest of the world to any countries that export crops to the EU. So it started with the EU and then because of trade relationships expanded to other countries. Many of the African countries would love to use GMO crops, but they can't because they can't afford to lose the European market.
And so that's really the main consequence that we've seen so far, is just this sort of environmental, or not environmental, but economic impact of the EU banning GMOs then.
Yeah. Some of the farmers in Africa has the lowest rate of productivity growth of any region in the world. And part of the reason is because many of those countries depend, and they don't even export every year. They export to the EU in years in which they have good crops, and they depend on rainfall, they depend on weather, and so maybe 1 in 3 years, 1 in 2 years, they'll be exporting to the EU, but they need the revenue from those exports, even though it's not every year. And so that is an important economic consequence for those countries.
Have any of the countries that have banned GMOs seen any kind of benefit to doing so, or has their food supply just suffered as a result?
Good question. I'm not aware of any that have seen benefit. The benefits mainly would be via trade. If you want, if they export to countries that want non-GMO, then they'll get a higher price for their non-GMO crop than they would for a GMO crop. And the higher price because lower yield. And also you have to, if you're going to have a GMO crop, you have to have a specialized supply chain that keeps it separate, keeps it completely segregated from the GM supply chain, which in the U.S. is the dominant supply chain. And so the whole system from planting and growing the crop to getting it in the bins and on the boats to wherever they're exporting it to is more expensive. They get a higher price. And so some people are, some farmers actually choose to grow non-GMO because they want that higher revenue that comes from the non-GMO. But other than, I'm not aware of any documented health benefits or other kinds of benefits other than the trade.
Now, you're a scientist, so your agenda is the pursuit of truth. Are there legitimate concerns about GMOs, sustainability, vulnerability, or is it really, from where you sit, does it all just seem like bad PR?
Never say never. There is always the potential that science is missing something, that the scientists who work on this have somehow missed an important trait or an important characteristic. But for me, when the USDA and the Food and Drug Administration and the EPA all separately state that GMO crops, as used in the United States, are safe and effective and virtually identical to the non-GMO varieties, I have to trust them. I don't have any reason not to trust them. They're the scientists who have worked on this, and they're the government employees who've been charged with judging the extent to which this has an effect on U.S. Consumers, and they all say, no, it doesn't. So I don't see anything, but there's always possibility that the scientists have missed something.
We've been talking with Purdue Professor of Agricultural Economics, Wally Tyner. Wally, thank you for your time and your knowledge.
Sure, anytime.
Up next, we'll explore some of the history of GMOs, and we'll also touch on some of the promises of GMOs that haven't quite panned out with IUPUI Earth Sciences Professor Gabe Filippelli and Purdue Professor of Botany and Plant Pathology Dr. Peter Goldsboro. We'll also address your questions, comments, and concerns on Facebook and Twitter as well at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're talking about GMOs and some of the concerns surrounding them. And right now we're joined by Professor of Earth Sciences and Director of the Center for Urban Health at IUPUI, Dr. Gabe Filippelli.
Thanks for having me.
And via Skype is Purdue Professor of Botany and Plant Pathology, Dr. Peter Goldsboro. Peter, thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon.
And of course, we'll take your comments and questions on social media. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Gabe Filippelli, GMOs have a long history, probably a lot longer than some might think. Just how long have we been eating genetically modified foods?
We've been eating them for decades, actually. And it's sort of that progression from a hybridization to now GMOs, and GMOs have become pervasive in our food supplies, actually.
Would you say that we've been eating them for even longer than that? Because we've been sort of selectively breeding for centuries, millennia, right?
In a sense, this is just an offspring of Gregor Mendel's work with hybridization a long time ago. The difference is that, you know, we are actually now manipulating the genes in a very specific manner of some of these organisms. And so in that sense, the true GMO, I would call it, has been around for decades now, though.
Yes. Now we can essentially go into the code and edit in or out certain traits. And you mentioned the old-fashioned way of doing that. When we look at the more modern definition of genetically modified organisms and we see that sort of genetic fine-tuning, how long have we been doing that, sort of that reason that we have this debate nowadays and scary words like frankenfood and things like that?
Sure. We've been doing it for, like I said, for decades. Yeah. It started off in a simple way of just trying to make plants more resistant to herbicides and pesticides and herbs and pest invasions. And then we've evolved into the second generation where we're modifying them to be much more drought tolerant or flood tolerant or heat tolerant and so forth. And so it's allowed us to expand the range of a lot of major grain crops, for example, globally.
Dr. Peter Goldsborough, anything to add on that point?
Yeah, we've been doing this for 25 years. The first genetically modified using this modern methodology was a tomato that was supposed to have a longer shelf life. But we've been doing this now for 25 years, and we have some new techniques, gene editing, which is another form of genetic modification that are moving into the mainstream and, in my opinion, important for the future of crop agriculture.
Gabe, are there any studies out there that suggest that GMO foods are in any way bad for the consumer?
No studies support that the consumption of GMO foods are bad. I'll reflect perhaps in a little bit about the other related activities with GMO utilization, which is some of the herbicide and pesticide mixtures that are being used now and some health concerns about that.
So then where do some of these concerns about GMOs then find their footing? I see foods marketed as non-GMO all the time. What are some of the arguments against it?
Well, I've also seen gluten-free water, believe it or not, on the shelf. So the arguments against it are, do we really know what the value, nutritional value of these foods are? And are they potentially causing long-term health impacts on people? There doesn't seem to be any evidence that that's the case, though.
Mark on Facebook is calling me out, and I appreciate this, Mark. He says, your last comment tells me your position clearly. Has anyone ever tried to scare me away from GMOs? And Mark says his answer is no, but the information that has been shared with Mark clearly tells him that this is an unproven technology with unknown consequences. Your thoughts on that?
I believe that it's because it's been going on for decades, it doesn't seem very unproven to me, at least. And the health studies that they've done on the actual GMO products themselves have shown no link to any morbidity or mortality in both animal and human models. I think the concern that I rightfully have, I think, is that glyphosate itself has been listed as a probable human carcinogen. Glyphosate is this Roundup, you know, they have this Roundup ready crops. And because a lot of fields have become more resistant to glyphosate effects, they're having to add in another chemical. It's a 2,4-D, which is related to Agent Orange, actually. And that mixture, it's been called Enlist Duo. The EPA approved it, but it's not really been tested adequately. And the New England Journal of Medicine just came out with a report saying, listen, there's some concerns that this mixture is an endocrine disrupting mixture, so that's really harmful for our hormonal systems, and it might also lead to DNA damage, like long term DNA damage. And I'm not saying it does, but they're saying, hold on a minute, we need to study this more.
But this is the effects of the actual pesticides and herbicides as far as the actual GMO foods, eating them. If the same pesticides and herbicides are applied, from what I understand, from what I'm hearing, it seems just as safe as ever. Dr. Peter Goldsborough, is that your assessment as well?
Yeah, you're right, Matt. I mean, these pesticides have been approved for use. And as with any pesticide, there are concerns about how safe they are and limiting exposure. And that's one of the functions of the EPA, is to make sure that they're applied safely and that if there are residues that are in the foods that we consume, that those residues are below a certain limit, just like there are limits on how much lead there is allowed to be in water or other things like that.
Mark,
so there are regulations in place to try to minimize any potential effect of these pesticides.
Mark on Facebook goes on to say, why has the industry worked so hard to buy? He reiterates, yes, buy FDA approval so that this fish that we're talking about isn't going to be labeled GMO based when sold or served, is if it's a healthy choice, then why not just promote that? And of course, we're talking about the fish. Your area of expertise, Dr. Goldsboro and Gabe Filippelli, is more on vegetable GMOs. But can you speak to that at all about the idea of buying FDA approval?
So this is Peter Goldsboro. I will say that in the past there was a desire by the industry to not label these, because labeling them would be seen as stigmatizing them in some way or another. Now that philosophy, that approach has changed, and very soon, I think it's 2020, there will be labels that will be required to indicate that something has been, I think the term is bioengineered rather than genetically modified. So that's the place where we are now. I think yes, from a consumer acceptance standpoint, not wanting to label these genetically modified foods was probably a mistake from a public opinion point of view.
Is there a cultural component to some of the hesitancy around GMOs? I mean, several other countries have embraced these products, but the EU, most notably, has been more hesitant to allow GMOs. There's a ban. And can you speak to why there's that discrepancy?
Well, I'll chime in as a native of the UK, but someone who's lived in the United States for 35 years now. Most of this is due to political influence. In Europe, the green parties are much more influential than they are in the States, and that's been a factor that has driven this. I will point out that if you ask the medical agencies like the American Medical Association or the equivalent bodies in Europe, they all have the same position, that there are no medical safety concerns with the products that are on the market today.
So we're talking about the concerns. On the other hand, being able to modify a product suggests perhaps we can add health benefits. Dr. Goldsboro, there are GMOs out there that offer benefits to the consumer, like minimizing allergens, or perhaps maximizing nutrition.
Well, I think if the industry that developed these products, if the first thing that they had come out with would have been something that benefited the consumer directly, then there would have been much more rapid and broad acceptance of these products. But almost everything that's on the market today that is genetically modified is of use to the producer, to the farmer. So things like making something that's resistant to a herbicide or resistant to insects, these are traits that are of primary benefit to the growers. It allows them to be more efficient at how they produce these crops. And there's actually very little that's on the market at the moment that is of direct benefit to consumers. Now, there are products that have been developed. There's longer-lasting tomato that I mentioned earlier. There's a non-browning apple, an apple that when you cut it open, will not turn brown. That has been approved and will be probably in the supermarkets within the next couple of years. And there are soybean oils that now are more like olive oil than soybean oil, and that's a consumer benefit. But these are relatively small niche products so far. There aren't many things out there that are of direct benefit to the consumer.
And I might add that there's that some products have been held up quite a bit by regulatory fears. One is golden rice. This is an example of a product that's not really a niche product at all. It's rice that has hyperaccumulated vitamin A in it. And the number of cases of blindness from lack of vitamin A, particularly in Southeast Asia and other areas, is staggering. And if that rice, if that golden rice was approved, it would actually have therapeutic benefits and public health benefits across Southeast Asia, where rice consumption is their main grain.
And one of the touted benefits of GMOs is that they promise to be low pesticide or herbicide crops. But we've also heard about that quality sort of dropping off after a few years, right, Gabe?
That's right. And that's been shown in field tests and so forth, that they're not quite the boon that we thought they were going to be. Some of the fears that people had, of course, on the direct consumption of GMOs being a problem, those have not arisen. There was fears of something called horizontal gene transfer. So these manufactured genes would get out into the wild environment and impact natural ecosystems. There doesn't seem to be much evidence for that yet. But with anything, there is a need to actually have this precautionary principle behind the way you approach some of these products. So I think that the general consumer who's afraid of GMO or doesn't know anything about it has gone overboard. However, I think it's the responsibility of researchers and others to carefully look at all of these products and continue looking at them, because for example, something might not have a short-term health impact or environmental impact, but it could have a long-term or a multi-generational one. And I think that's the role that's the stance that the New England Journal of Medicine had when not talking about the GMOs themselves, but talking about the pesticide mixtures, the herbicide mixtures, I'm sorry, is let's make sure we devote some resources to continue studying the potential health impacts of this.
Have there been a lot of expressed frustrations regarding this sort of, you know, a few years of without crop rotations and we lose the GMO benefits? I mean, are some farmers just fed up with some of these products, or are they still being very highly used? Dr. Goldsboro?
Oh, they're being very highly used. And part of that is actually that there aren't so many alternatives that are available. If you're a corn or soybean grower, you don't have very many suppliers of non-GMO varieties that you can buy from today. 95% of the corn and soybeans that's grown in the States are GMO varieties, and that's what the seed companies are producing.
I can remember reading news a few years back about genetically modified plants being found in the wild where they shouldn't be. I think the example was transgenic canola growing, thriving really in North Dakota. There have been other examples, and we hear about wild invasives taking over certain areas, but it's still a very man-made problem. But have there been any problems with GMO crops making their way into the wild, or do we just find them and say, oh, there they are, and there's really no problem?
Well, interestingly, the biggest problem has been with the farmers who are attempting to grow non-GMO products, for example, corn, mm-hmm. and they're proximal to or downwind of a field of GMO corn, and their supposed non-GMO corn is now infected with GMO corn, and so it's actually not it's not wild corn anymore. You know, corn is. It's a bad model because corn has been the most hybridized grain crop I could imagine. You know, we've been able to perfect it over hundreds of years of hybridization. But nevertheless, I think this horizontal gene transfer, which is what you're discussing, it more impacts the sister crop, so genetically modified corn, than mixing in with non-genetically modified corn. Rather than some of the fears that, oh, well, these unknown genes are going to infect an entire forest ecosystem and turn it into trees with legs or something like that.
With Dr. Goldsboro, the subject of proximity, I guess that's one that I hadn't thought about. You can't really grow GMOs next to organics, or can you? Are there exceptions?
Well, you can, but there is the potential for the spread of pollen from one crop to another. So that is a potential problem. It's one of the concerns that's been raised. I don't know that it's an enormous problem, but we've been contaminating our natural environment with cultivated crops for hundreds of years. And so I don't really see this as being something that's particularly novel. You know, corn and soybeans, neither of them originate in this part of the world, but they are our major crops.
As we sort of wrap up here, another argument against GMOs, some of the negativity surrounding GMOs came from a 2008 documentary called Food Inc., which was very popular, and it really kind of painted Monsanto as a sort of boogeyman in the world of corporate food. Among the points raised in that documentary is the question of who owns the seed? You know, people who have seen the documentary know that farmers are being sued in it because they collected seed from their own crops. And I know you're a scientist, but what about that argument against GMOs, Gabe, the sort of moral argument?
That comes up a lot when I teach about this. I teach a section on this. And young people actually are overwhelmingly, in my classes at least, concerned, informed about GMOs and very concerned about them. And then movies like Food Inc. just kind of tends to exacerbate that issue. So I think it's a big social issue about acceptance or not of GMOs. It's very clear that it's kind of uncomfortable when you can no longer own the progeny of your own seeds for a farmer. And I imagine that that's an awkward situation.
Dr. Goldsboro, final word along those lines?
Well, the Supreme Court are the ones who have ruled that genetically modified seeds that are patented by a university or by a company can't be replanted without permission from the owners. So it is a concern. But if there is value to these seeds, be they genetically modified or not, and farmers or vegetable growers, gardeners are willing to pay for them, then that's the marketplace that will decide that.
That'll have to be it. I want to thank my guests for the great insight. Dr. Gabe Filippelli, director of the Center for Urban Health at IUPUI. Thank you, Gabe.
Thank you.
And via Skype, professor of botany and plant pathology at Purdue, Dr. Peter Goldsboro. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
This episode was co-produced by Maggie Galon, whose first day on the job was yesterday. Way to hit the ground running, Maggie, and welcome to the team. Next time on All In, we'll talk with Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith about the Indiana Department of Child Services 1 year after the laundry list of recommended changes to the agency following the dramatic resignation of former director Mary Beth Bonaventura. We'll hear about how the agency has changed and what still needs to be done Thursday at 1. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In.